The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me on this fifth and final Sunday of October. A lot of show this evening, so let's get right to it. In the most forward-thinking companies, social good has moved from a single office of corporate social responsibility to becoming embedded into every single operation the company undertakes. One of the best examples of a purpose-driven company that is doing this is General Mills, headquartered in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And tonight, I will be joined by the executive director of the General Mills Foundation, Mary Jane Melendez, who will tell us about what the company describes as its five pursuits.
The company has a purpose of serving the world by making food people love. Underneath that purpose are our five pursuits, which are putting people first, building a culture of creating, making food with passion, earning people's trust, and treating the world with care.
And then you will hear from Carol Naughton, the president of Purpose Built Communities, an organization that is helping to revitalize the urban areas of America one neighborhood at a time.
Purpose Built Communities is a nonprofit pro bono consulting organization, and we help local leaders around the country revitalize neighborhoods to create healthy, sustainable places that have deep, broad, and durable pathways out of poverty.
And Kyle Zimmer, the president of First Book, will be back on the show to tell us about a new campaign to get books back into the hands of children and communities that were devastated by the recent spate of hurricanes. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, October 29th. Almost 4 out of every 10 children have had at least one adverse childhood experience, a study from Johns Hopkins Health finds. These include things like the death or incarceration of a parent, witnessing or being a victim of violence, or living with someone who has been suicidal or had a drug or alcohol problem. In what has become a familiar pattern the last several years, published tuition and fee prices increase at a relatively low, steady rate this year, but financial aid again failed to keep up, resulting in students paying more to attend college. Roughly 7,000 newborn babies across the world died every day in their first 28 days of life, according to a new report by the United Nations. The latest statistics show that of all the children under the age of 5 who died in 2016, 46% were under 28 days old. That's up from 41% in 2000. Now, that's a trend in the opposite direction for overall child mortality of kids under 5, which is at a new low of 5.6 million compared to 9.9 million in 2000. People are curious where the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative is directing its resources. Well, according to Vice News, 45 million of that has been targeted to two areas: prison reform and affordable housing. And finally, when 9.1 million acres of the Amazon rainforest burned in Brazil in 2016, it helped the world break a new record. Last year, more tree cover was lost globally than in any other year, covering an area roughly the size of New Zealand. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I will be back to speak with Mary Jane Melendez of the General Mills Foundation right after this.
Youth opportunities, strong communities, a healthy planet. Sounds like the work of social entrepreneurs. Yes, but it's also the work of artists. Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Upstart is committed to promoting artists as innovators, unleashing capital for creativity, and enabling sustainable creative lives. Find out more at www.upstartco-lab.org.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick. One of the most iconic names in all of business is General Mills, headquartered in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And their brands have been favorites of Americans for decades. Cheerios, Wheaties, Betty Crocker, Yoplait, Haagen-Dazs, Pillsbury, and many, many more. They're also a company that has done an exceptional job of aligning their mission and core values into the very operations of their business and through their philanthropy. And here to discuss that with us is Mary Jane Melendez, the Executive Director of the General Mills Foundation. Good evening, Mary Jane, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the work of the foundation and the social good that the company is focused on. Give us a little bit of the history of General Mills.
Absolutely. So General Mills actually began as a flour milling company 151 years ago on the banks of the Mississippi River. And over time, there were several mill companies that started along the river. Pillsbury was one of them as well. And in 1928, a gentleman by the name of James Ford Bell pulled all of these companies together, and that was the birth of the official General Mills Company. So we started as Washburn Crosby Company and became General Mills in 1928.
And just had your sesquicentennial, I guess is what they call it, last year.
We absolutely did.
Yeah. Turning to your philanthropic portfolio, you partnered with an outside consultant, FSG, and you conducted workshops with company and foundation staff and did visioning sessions and employee surveys, etc. And you really created a thoughtful, business-aligned, outcome-oriented engagement strategy. Tell us about that process and what you learned as a result of it, Mary Jane.
Absolutely. So stepping into this role as executive director, we took a little bit of time to really take in feedback from our key stakeholders. And we started with our General Mills Foundation Board of Trustees. And we asked them questions like, what is the foundation doing well? Where do we have opportunities to improve? And what advice do you have for the foundation team in this new business environment? And the learnings were absolutely fascinating in terms of where they saw opportunities for the foundation to be even more impactful. And because those key learnings were so insightful, we ended up taking those same questions to our employees all around the world. And it was fascinating because whether we were talking to an employee in Minneapolis or Mumbai or Melbourne, we heard the same thing. As a global food company, we should really be focused on food security and helping to alleviate hunger globally. As a company that relies completely on the health of Mother Nature, we better start paying attention to the planet, and sustainable agriculture is incredibly relevant to General Mills. What is the company doing in that space? And the third piece that we heard is that they didn't want us to walk away from the incredible community goodwill that this company has been doing for all of its existence, and they were very intentional about saying that's still really important to take care of communities where our employees live and work. And what I love about the new strategy is that it has the fingerprints of our employees completely across it. And that new strategy has not only allowed us to align more closely with our company's purpose and our core business, we brought food back to the center of our philanthropy, and it's been incredible, I think, the relevance in terms of the issues that we're focused on. And also, the employee engagement has skyrocketed since we've moved into this new strategic framework. And I think that's because employees are able to see a unique way that they can specifically engage and make a difference in the community, much more beyond, you know, of course, mentoring kids and packing meals are great, but really using their unique skill set that they're using every day on the job within the four walls of General Mills and taking that out into nonprofits and into the community. It's been really incredible to see that come to life.
Yeah, and it's amazing how employees will really engage in a strategy that they, in fact, created. And you're a purpose-driven company, and at the heart of all that, Mary Jane, are something called the five pursuits. What are those five pursuits?
Absolutely. So the company has a purpose of serving the world by making food people love. Underneath that purpose are our five pursuits, which are putting people first, building a culture of creating, making food with passion, earning people's trust, and treating the world with care. And in my role, I have the privilege to see how our employees serve, how they're putting people first, whether it's responding to natural disasters in their community or in how they treat the world with care when they're going up and doing, you know, park cleanups or working on plans for, you know, how are we going to bring back pollinators. It's just been incredible to see them want to engage. And at General Mills, we refer to that engagement with its, you know, the skills and the expertise of our employees as the intellectual philanthropy of the company, which in my mind, I think, you know, couple that with a contribution and bring that horsepower of your, you know, the passion and power of your employees to the table. And boy, you can really move the needle on some of these big issues in a meaningful way.
Picking up on that people first strategy, what have been the real business benefits of focusing on your people?
I would say a few things. One, when you focus on the employees and when you put them at the center and allow them to be part of this work, you see a more engaged and committed workforce for sure. You see them, you know, through the foundation, they are much more connected to their community. They understand the issues that are going on. They're bringing creative solutions forward to our community partners and thinking differently and really frame breaking old ways of doing things. And I think pushing people to innovate and be creative with these different, you know, ways to solve these big societal challenges that, you know, continue to grow over time, and harnessing that power and passion has been really incredible. And they come back so proud to work at this company that is allowing them time, whether it's, you know, during work or on the weekends, creating opportunities for them to engage. They're so proud to be, you know, part of a company that has had this culture for, you know, all 150 years that we've been in existence of giving back to the community and, you know, putting people first and treating the world with care. It's part of the fabric that I think makes General Mills such an incredible place to work.
Yeah. Well, you touched on this a moment ago, but General Mills has three major pillars of its philanthropy, and they're all tied closely, as you said, to your core business and food systems knowledge, and you have some very specific targets to be met by 2020. I'm going to ask you to speak to each of them for a moment, if you would. The first is increasing food security. What is the issue here, and what is General Mills doing about it?
So our investment around increasing food security is trying to address the fact that we have 1 in 9 people on the planet that don't know where their next meal is coming from. And you think about the growth of the population over time and how on earth are we going to be able to feed this population that is expanding so rapidly.
Yeah.
And we believe as a global food company that we can make a real difference in removing barriers to food security. We think about, you know, really leveraging the company's unique assets and increasing employee engagement to, you know, really working on leveraging the company's food expertise and capabilities and drawing upon our unique strengths to have the greatest impact. So there's actually three areas under food security that we're really zooming in on at this point, and that is global school meals, mm-hmm. food rescue and recovery, and community food systems. And if it's okay, I would love to give you just an example to illustrate the type of work that we're doing to bring this to life.
Please do.
Thank you. In the area of global school meals, we are really working to strengthen the reach and impact of school meal programs globally. And we have an ambition by 2020 to enable 100 million school meals for at-risk youth globally. And we're partnering with organizations like No Kid Hungry, like the Greggs Foundation in the UK, Breakfast Clubs of Canada, the Food Research and Action Center, and the World Food Program. And it's been incredible to see how students are able to learn, concentrate in school, pay attention when they start their day with a full tummy.
For
you know,
sure.
Imagine how hard it is in the morning when if you don't have your cup of coffee.
Oh.
And, you know, that's a tough day at work. And these kids oftentimes, because of, you know, the family situations that they're living in, because a lot of them are living in poverty, they don't have access to meals. And school becomes a place where they can get this support. So with working with these partners over the past 18 months, we've been so proud of the work that they have done to enable more than 50 million school meals that we've turned on since we've started focusing in this area. So there's a lot of power in providing that, you know, basic need, that meal for these kids every day.
Yeah, that's great.
The other area that I would highlight is around food rescue. And that, I think, is a critically important issue, not only on the food security side, but when it comes to sustainability as well. And what's so heartbreaking to me is thinking about the fact that nearly 40% of the food that is produced on the planet ends up in a landfill.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, more than 800 million people are hungry. And you think about the inputs that go into growing a tomato, the water, the sun, the transportation, the handling, all to have that, you know, beautiful vegetable fruit end up in a landfill. And so it's things like that that we're trying to help you really, you know, turn the corner on, and we want to advance innovative solutions in food recovery and food waste reduction. So we have a significant ambition by 2020 to rescue 1 billion pounds of safe and edible food from the landfill and instead redirect that food to hunger relief agencies to help provide much needed meals to individuals who, again, don't know where their next meal is coming from.
You are definitely a data-driven company with metrics everywhere you turn. The second pillar is advancing sustainable agriculture, and among other things, you have really increased your charitable investments in this area, haven't you?
We have. In fact, this is a new area. The sustainable agriculture pillar that we invest in today came to life through the suggestions of our employees, who are very planet conscious, very much about sustainability and taking care of the planet. So, you know, it's here for the next generation. And it was fascinating to be able to say, okay, if we look in that area, which is brand new for General Mills, where do you even start? Because sustainability is there's such a broad range of subjects that you could tackle there.
Mm-hmm.
And we've identified four to start with as we're really kind of stepping into this new area of philanthropic investments. So we are working today to support smallholder farmers that are important to our raw material supply chain. So you can think about those as the farmers who are growing vanilla in Madagascar for Haagen-Dazs ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the types of farmers that we're supporting and making sure they're getting, you know, fair prices for the product that they're growing, that their kids are in school, that their livelihoods are improving over time. And we're seeing that happen already, which has been fantastic. We've got an incredible partnership with CARE, who's helping to do a lot of that work on the ground. We also are investing in priority watersheds that are important to General Mills, either because we have manufacturing facilities near them or because we have so many farmers who are drawing water to water their fields. So we're really looking at priority watersheds globally and ensuring that they have sustainability plans in place, because if we don't take care of them now, in 50, 75 years, they're not going to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to invest now to turn the corner on this. The third area is really about soil health. And I tell you, Denver, I did not ever think I would be talking so much about dirt in my entire life, but it's become one of the most fascinating subjects for me in terms of the benefits of soil health to the planet. In terms of, when you have healthy soil, it sequesters carbon, it holds more water, you need less fertilizer,
mm-hmm.
you can get better yields. I mean, it's just, it's incredible what soil health can do for the planet and for climate change. So I'm so proud that the company is investing in that area. And then the final pillar under sustainable agriculture is really around pollinators. So I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners are familiar with colony collapse disorder.
Yeah.
And we are, General Mills is the world's largest corporate supporter of pollinator health and habitat restoration. And we are making investments that are supporting large-scale habitat development and pesticide reduction across 300,000 acres of farm. And these are farms that supply ingredients for Cheerios and Muir Glen and Cascadian Farm and Annie's and several other General Mills brands. And I love seeing pictures of these almond groves in California that now, between the almond trees, have these beautiful pollinator habitats. And the bees are just, you know, flying a few feet from the tree to, you know, the flowers, versus having to be trucked across the country from beekeepers in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the way to California. So it's been really incredible to see this partnership come to life with the Xerxes Society, and having all of these pollinator habitats not only do good for, you know, the world and do good for pollinators, but really beautify communities at the same time.
Yeah, it's such a critical issue, and I don't think people fully appreciate how important it really is. Finally, there is Strengthening Hometown Communities Initiative, and I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar with your Box Tops for Education cause marketing program. Tell us about this and some of the other work in this area.
Absolutely. So the Box Tops for Education program, which is underneath the Strengthening Hometown Communities area that we invest in, that program was actually started just over 20 years ago. And since that time, Box Tops has invested nearly $8 million in nearly 80,000 U.S. schools across the country. These are K-8 schools. And as many people know, budgets have been reduced and more than $800 million through Box Tops for Education.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that school budgets have been reduced, and these schools are really having a hard time with resources. And what's, I think, so beautiful about the Box Tops for Education program is that these dollars are completely unrestricted. So whether a school needs physical education equipment or iPads for students or a new air conditioning system, they can leverage the Box Tops funding, which is 10 cents per each Box Top that is redeemed,
mm-hmm.
for anything that their school needs. So we've been so proud to have nearly 80% of U.S. K-8 schools participating in that program over the last 20 years.
Yeah, and tell us about Outnumber Hunger.
Absolutely. So the Outnumber Hunger program is a program that actually was started with a number of our brands in partnership with Feeding America that also allows consumers to get engaged. So what you would see on, for example, a box of Cheerios would be a promotion about hunger in your local community. And a lot of times individuals want to help people who are close to them and in their community. They want to be, you know, active and engaged citizens. And that Outnumber Hunger program actually allowed consumers to go online and enter a code and unlock a meal for someone in their local community. So every code that was redeemed, General Mills provided a contribution to their local Feeding America food bank.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, more than 200 Feeding America food banks across the country that then in turn ensured that there was food and meals ready to go to those communities to help alleviate hunger. It's just been incredible to harness the power of the brands in philanthropy.
And you thank these consumers by giving them a little music, don't you?
They do get a little music. They get a little country music in thanks for their for unlocking that meal for a neighbor.
Yeah, I know you have a partnership with Pandora around that. You know, you mentioned a few moments ago about your volunteerism, and you said something along the lines how it has really evolved in recent years. Tell us how it's changed, and a little bit also about your Think Global, Volunteer Local initiative.
Absolutely. So I have to say, General Mills volunteers are some of the most generous on the planet. And I love to share this statistic. At General Mills, 83% of our employees globally serve as volunteers in their community. And I think that, again, just speaks to the culture of this company and how our employees, again, are bringing the company's pursuits to life. And I think that statistic is incredibly important because if you look at other surveys, like the one that CECP does every year, the Giving in Numbers survey, the average corporate volunteerism rate is in the low 30 percentile range. Mm. So General Mills employees are incredible when it comes to engaging and serving their community. And since we have moved to this new strategic framework, which anchors our giving in food security, sustainable agriculture, and hometown giving, we have seen employees from across the globe reach out to say, I would like to help, you know, I have food research expertise, or I have food science, I'm a food scientist. How can I help to alleviate hunger in Africa? And it's just been remarkable because we have employees who are, you know, getting their MBA or studying sustainable agriculture, and they're saying, hey, how can I apply what I'm learning at school, what I'm doing at work, and actually engage in the community to help advance some of this work? And it's been so incredible to see that happening, whether employees are in France or in the UK or in Argentina or Mexico or here in Minneapolis. The foundation fields those types of requests on a daily basis, and it's just, I think, incredible to see how generous the employees are and how they want to engage and give back.
Yeah, even some of your retired employees are participating, aren't they?
Absolutely. We have retirees that are engaged in volunteerism across the country. We actually have a group here that works for an organization called St. Joseph's Home for Children, and it's a place where children who are separated from their parents can go for a little bit of respite, and our retirees actually every month go in there and bake birthday cakes for those kids who are separated from their families. And it's just, it's incredible to see the fact that they're still, you know, serving the world by making food people love well into retirement.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about your corporate culture. I saw in a recent employee engagement survey, 75% of General Mills employees said it was a great place to work. That is really quite impressive, Mary Jane. What are some of the things that you have done to make the work culture so healthy and so inviting?
Well, I think General Mills has been really intentional and very thoughtful about creating this culture here. One, I think we were very fortunate to have founders who were very forward-thinking and invested in communities in the late 1800s. This is not something that is just, you know, coming up new within our culture. This is something that has been part of the DNA of General Mills since day one. And I think having that foundation there has enabled the company to do things much differently. And I think some of the things they've done, like they've put the General Mills Foundation literally on what we call Main Street. So we are in the heart of the world headquarters community where every employee passes by the foundation as they're coming into work every day.
Mm-hmm.
And to dedicate the resources that they have since the foundation was established. And that's since 1954, General Mills and its foundation have contributed more than $2 billion back to charitable causes worldwide. So again, it's that legacy of giving that I think has inspired just an incredible culture of giving back and of putting people first. The other thing that they do is, you know, they've done really wonderful things like we've got wonderful restaurants within the building. We've got beautiful workout facilities. There's a doctor's office here. There's an auto service center on site. So you are in beautiful surroundings every day, and you're working with world-class, generous human beings. I have to give our HR team a lot of credit for their recruitment efforts. They seem to recruit some of the most talented, generous, bright, results-oriented human beings I've ever worked with. And boy, is it a pleasure to work with those types of individuals who are not only driving incredible business results, but are also driving incredible community impact.
Where do I apply? Sounds great. Hey, I'm a big football fan, and I know that Super Bowl 52 will be coming to your hometown of Minneapolis this coming year. I think the game is going to be played on February 4th of 2018, something that General Mills Foundation is helping with is bringing a super school breakfast to 52 schools across Minnesota and some other things around that game. Tell us about what you're doing in connection with next year's Super Bowl.
Oh, we are so excited to be part of the Super Bowl 52 Legacy Fund Committee. And that is a group that's actually been extending philanthropy across the state of Minnesota for the 52 weeks leading up to Super Bowl 52. And it was really fun at the beginning to sit down with the committee to brainstorm ways that General Mills could be engaged. And one of the things that we talked about was the incredible need right here in our home state to provide school breakfast to kids across the state. And so we sat down with the Legacy Fund and said, you know, what if General Mills brought to life new school breakfast programs to 52 schools that today don't have that program, but once they receive the funding from the General Mills contribution, are able to provide universal breakfast to every child in their school. And we've been so proud to partner with the Legacy Fund to bring that to life. And we're providing so many meals on a daily basis to these kids who otherwise are starting their day hungry and on an empty tummy. And boy, again, it's hard to learn when you're hungry.
Sure is. Well, let me close with this, Mary Jane. You know, people who lead corporate giving efforts that are on the cutting edge are usually the best people to ask where they see the future of corporate philanthropy and social good going. What do you envision happening in this field over the next 5 to 10 years?
You know, Denver, I think that we are going to see corporations continue to bring forward expertise that is unique to their specific business. I think you're going to see corporations engaging in philanthropy in ways that go beyond cash giving, but instead really go to sharing technology, sharing knowledge and know-how, engaging employees and leveraging their expertise. And I think I do see the field changing, and I think we're moving from, you know, an era where a lot of companies were giving, and there was a lot of community goodwill happening, which is incredible. But I think what organizations are also looking for is ways to articulate the unique impact that they're making. So I think it's going to be much more targeted, much more focused. So, for example, General Mills, you know, we had been funding in a number of areas across a number of causes, and we really said, gosh, if we step back, if we did fewer things but went deeper, could we actually move the needle on things like, you know, food security or sustainable agriculture? And I believe that we can, but it's really hard to, you know, say no to these organizations who may be outside of your focus area but are doing incredible work. And I think focus is going to continue to get sharper over time. I think the impact piece is going to be incredibly important. Organizations and our partners want to be able to talk about the difference that's being made.
Yeah.
And if the difference is not being made, how do we change what we're doing so we can drive impact? So it's about, I think, frame-breaking old approaches and being very innovative with new ways to solve these problems.
Well, Mary Jane Melendez, the Executive Director of the General Mills Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. If people should be interested in learning more about these issues, maybe about the Outnumber Hunger campaign or Box Tops for Education, your website would be?
Our website is www.generalmills.com. Click on the responsibility page and you'll be taken to all of the good work the company is doing around the world.
Thanks so much, Mary Jane. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
My pleasure, Denver. Thanks so much for having me.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Top companies have now begun to discover a reliable source for skilled new talent, and they're finding great success with employees who are productive, engaged, and innovative. Explore the country's largest untapped talent pool, 24 million Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner for companies looking to accelerate their disability employment efforts, attract, hire, and retain. Learn more at NOD.org. Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
One of the complaints you so often hear in the social sector is that some of the very best programs, which have a proven track record, are rarely replicated or can't be customized to work under a different set of circumstances. But tonight, we'll discuss one that is being replicated and around one of the most difficult challenges we face, revitalizing the poorest urban neighborhoods in America. It's called Purpose-Built Communities, and here to tell us about it is their president, Carol Naughton. Good evening, Carol, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. I'm delighted to be here.
Give us a snapshot of Purpose-Built Communities and what the organization does.
Purpose-Built Communities is a nonprofit pro bono consulting organization, and we help local leaders around the country revitalize neighborhoods to create healthy, sustainable places that have deep, broad, and durable pathways out of poverty.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into the model, that inspired this movement, and that was the East Lake community in Atlanta. Let's look at the overall issue of poverty, Carol, if we can. How many Americans are living in poverty today, and how many of those are children?
So over 40 million Americans continue to live in poverty. This is 50-plus years after we started a war on poverty in the early 1960s. And while we have certainly won some victories, we have not yet won the war. And what we have learned is that when low-income families live in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty, their road to hoe is simply harder than if they happen to be a low-income person in a more economically diverse neighborhood. And when we look at poverty and how it affects children, we see that almost 1 in 4, 1 in 5 American children continue to live in poverty. And when I'm talking about poverty, I'm talking about a family of four living below $24,000 and change. So we're talking about people living on very little money.
What are the human and economic costs of childhood poverty?
As a country, we lose about $500 billion, that's billion with a B, in economic output every year is associated with childhood poverty. Now, many people in America don't see the problems associated with concentrated poverty in their daily life. You know, they get up in the morning, they drive to the train, they take the train into the office, and they do what they do and then go back home, and they may not see the consequences. But when you start to think about these economic impacts, people today and our children are going to be dramatically impacted by issues associated with poverty unless we do something about it.
And one of those impacts is life expectancy. In fact, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation mapped the differences in life expectancy from one neighborhood to another, just a couple miles apart. How dramatic can those differences be?
In New Orleans, for example, there are two neighborhoods 3 miles apart where the life expectancy difference is 25 years.
Oh, wow.
25 years.
That's incredible.
And that's not uncommon. If you go to almost any city in America and map out the life expectancy based on where people live, you will see a 20 to 25 year discrepancy as a result of geography. You know, geography should not be the determining factor of our life expectancy in this country.
Yeah. And, you know, many might suspect that the cause of premature death in these communities is lack of access to health care. But there are far more significant factors than that which are shortening these lifespans. What would some of those be?
So you're exactly right. What we call the social determinants of health in the public health world, the social determinants of health are things like access to housing, good education, jobs, living in an environment that's free or has reduced pollutants, all those kinds of things that can get in the way of living a healthy life. And what we know now from the work of Dr. Jack Shonkoff and others is that when you live in a neighborhood of concentrated poverty, there's this concept of toxic stress that absolutely impacts your body and your brain and changes who you become. And that's terrible. That we're supposed to be better than that in America.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Carol. It hasn't always been taken for granted that poverty and place were really tied together. When did we as a nation finally come to that realization?
We've been able to document for the last 10 years or so that poverty and place are intimately tied together in this country. And I want to be very clear. Lots of the places that we're talking about are neighborhoods where people of color have been concentrated as a result of racist policies that have been implemented over the last 120 years by the federal, state, and local government. Policies associated with Jim Crow in the South, but also every city in America. In fact, I'm reading now Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, which documents city by city, state by state, all of the different policies that our government put in place that have resulted in creating these neighborhoods of concentrated poverty. And while none of us who are here today are responsible for creating that problem, we are all responsible for trying to fix it.
Absolutely. Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, the model that purpose-built communities is based upon is a neighborhood in Atlanta called Eastlake. Tell us about Eastlake and how did this whole thing originally get started?
Eastlake was a neighborhood and is a neighborhood in Atlanta, in the late 1960s, a public housing community was built out there called East Lake Meadows, and it was as far east as you can be in the city of Atlanta and remain in the city limits. So it was as far out as you could be. At that point, when the public housing project was developed, there were very little social services available to support the neighborhood. And so as people moved in, immediately the consequences of being isolated, being warehoused, being stigmatized started to play out. The children who lived in that community went to one school, where the people who lived in the single-family homes nearby went to another school. Mm-hmm. So there were no real ways to kind of break up that experience of living in concentrated poverty. When I first came out to Eastlake in 1995, it was a neighborhood where that was struggling in every single way. The crime rate was 18 times the national average.
18 times?
18 times the national average. Andy Young used to say that the only times the haves and the have-nots came together in Eastlake was over the $35 million a year drug trade that emanated from that neighborhood. If you looked at any statistic, if it was bad to have a lot of it, Eastlake had a ton of it. And if it was good to have a lot of it, Eastlake didn't have enough of it. But Eastlake had some amazing people who lived there, including a great leader named Eva Davis, who had had a vision about creating a wonderful community that served children well, that was integrated racially and economically, and felt like any other good neighborhood. And at the same time as Davis was having this dream, an Atlanta businessman, a guy named Tom Cousins, who is really an Atlanta business legend.
He is.
Tom had started Cousins Properties in 1958, and by 1964 had started his first family foundation. Giving back to the community was really part of his DNA. But I think by the mid-1990s, he was really a frustrated philanthropist. And he had this aha experience when he read an op-ed piece in the New York Times that said over 70% of the men in the New York State prison system came from just 8 neighborhoods. He couldn't believe that that could possibly be true.
That's a heck of a statistic.
It's stunning, right? And so Tom called the author, who was a professor at Rutgers, and it was verified for him. And he called the chief of police in Atlanta and said, I've read this about New York. It's been verified for me. Do we have the same situation in Atlanta? And the chief said, well, yeah, Tom, everybody knows that. And he started telling him about Eastlake. And Tom went out there to see it and was stunned by the hopelessness and stunned that really the opportunities that he had had in this country were not available for the children who lived out there.
So you get involved in Eastlake in this revitalization project in 1995, and as you mentioned, the community is pretty flat out, 30% of a high school graduation rate, 5% of fifth graders are hitting the math standards.
Exactly.
40% of the housing is uninhabitable. But as you mentioned a moment ago, you really had to start by building relationships and trust in the community, probably that had had many, many promises made to it, only to see them broken. That is not an easy task, Carol. How did you go about doing it?
You know, it wasn't easy in Eastlake either. Miss Davis was a very strong leader. She was nobody's fool. And because people had tried to come in and some people said, hi, I'm from so-and-so and I'm here to help. Or other people had come in and really tried to take advantage of the people who live there, people had their guard up. And the reality is that this plan that the Atlanta Housing Authority and the Eastlake Foundation that Tom Cousins had created, the plan was, or the idea of the plan, because there wasn't a plan when we first started, but the idea was so audacious of creating a really brand new neighborhood with better housing and new schools and new opportunities for folks. It was almost stunning, and I think Ms. Davis had to go, okay, let's take a minute.
Yeah.
But we met every week for 2.5 years for about a 2-hour planning committee meeting that were often very, very difficult meetings. Ms. Davis chaired those meetings, and the vitriol of living a hard life for 60 years came out in those meetings, and they really were difficult, but we kept coming back. And I think the secret was to continue coming back, even when you had had a really bad meeting the week before, or you had been called some really bad names the week before, or somebody had thrown down and said, hell no, we're not going to do this. Keep coming back, and coming back with an open mind and an open heart about what we were going to try to do together.
Well, your approach in Eastlake and in the other communities where you work are built upon 3 major pillars. And the first, and where you started in Eastlake because of the acute need, was mixed income housing. Why was that so important, and how did you approach it?
So we knew that concentrating people in poverty wasn't working, and we wanted to create a way to create affordable housing within a more economically diverse apartment community. And so that's called now mixed income housing. Mm-hmm. And we had to figure out the legal and financial model to be able to do this. So the Atlanta Housing Authority and its development partners were really on the cutting edge of creating the legal and financial model. And in fact, I worked for the Atlanta Housing Authority at this point, and I was the deal lawyer.
Yeah.
So that was really what my job was.
Right.
Although I got to do a lot of other things, my job was really creating the legal and financial model to do mixed income housing. Our theory at that point, because it had not been done before, was that by integrating people into a more economically diverse community, you would change some of the things about the neighborhood. You would be able to attract investment into the neighborhood. So, for example, where there hadn't been a grocery store in 40 years, as a result of doing mixed-income housing, we were able to attract a Publix grocery store
right.
into the neighborhood. We've been able to attract branch banks. We've been able to attract the kinds of neighborhood-serving retail that everybody wants. But,
and we all take for granted.
And we take for granted if you happen to live in a neighborhood
That's
with
right.
resources.
Mm-hmm.
But if you live in a neighborhood that is under-resourced, those are the things that are missing. And mixed-income housing helps attract that additional investment. It's also kind of a reset for the neighborhood because it signals to the community that this is a neighborhood worth your time and your investment. And that's part of the definition of a healthy neighborhood.
Yeah, sure is. And mixed-income housing, it was really 50-50, wasn't it?
It is in Eastlake, 50-50. 50% of every apartment building are rented to families who qualify for public housing assistance, and the other 50% are rented at the market rates, whatever the market will bear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the great thing about that is if you're a low-income family and living in a subsidized unit in that building, the quality of the services delivered are the same as the people paying market rate. So if you call because you've got a problem in your apartment, you're going to get the same level of service that somebody who's paying top dollar does. And that, frankly, hadn't happened for many low-income families, maybe ever.
Yeah.
So it's that idea that you're delivering the kind of service that people are willing to pay for creates a sense of pride and a sense of, yes, this is my community, and I'm going to be engaged and be a part of it.
Yeah, and with every building 50-50, nobody really knows who's paying market rate and who's getting a subsidy, which is absolutely fantastic.
That's right.
The second leg of the stool, and so important to breaking the cycle of intergenerational poverty, is education, cradle to college pipeline. And the centerpiece of that was the first charter school in Atlanta. That has been quite the story. Tell us about it.
Oh, yeah. This is one of my favorite pieces of the Eastlake story. Drew Charter School is now in its 17th year of operation, I think, and we serve about 1,900 young people from pre-K all the way through high school. In fact, we had our first graduating class.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a big day. We had 100% graduation, and every single young person who graduated was accepted to college.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think about college, I think both about four-year colleges. We had kids who went to the Ivy Leagues and kids who went to the University of Georgia and Georgia
yep.
Tech and Georgia State. But we also had kids who said, I want to do something more technical in nature, who were going on to learn how to code or to do something else that made sense for them. So we think about college in a really broad way, but we know everybody in this country really needs post-secondary education.
Mm-hmm. And the final piece, it was around health and wellness. What took place in Eastlake to address that important issue?
One of our most important partners early on was the YMCA in Eastlake, which is the Y is actually called the Eastlake Family YMCA, and they were a really kind of but-for partner early on. They were one of the first places where people came together across race and income and ethnicity and religion to recreate together, to take better care of themselves. And they were a great partner. They remain a great partner. In fact, one of the things that they do so well is they provide the PE instruction for the elementary school at Drew Charter School. So they're really embedded into the school. It's a terrific partner, and there are others, but the Y is in my heart will always be one of the most important early partners.
Well, this is fairly complex, Carol, and it's got a lot of moving parts. And the linchpin for a real successful revitalization program is something that is referred to as community quarterback. What is a community quarterback, and what role does it play in this undertaking?
I'm so glad you asked that question. We think that the community quarterback is really the secret sauce. It's what creates the opportunities for these really complex cross-sectoral long-term partnerships to work really well to help create a great platform that will allow people to work their way up and out of poverty. That community quarterback is typically a newly created nonprofit whose only reason in life is to make sure that this initiative works. It's not an add-on someplace. It's really a separate organization, and you recruit board members, some from the community and some from other places, who can help expand the constituency of people who care about this neighborhood, people who are willing to use their relationships, their chits, sometimes their treasure, to help make this happen.
Yeah, and they coordinate and they connect. And I guess you also have a single point of accountability, don't you?
You really do. When I left the Atlanta Housing Authority in 2001, I became the executive director of the Eastlake Foundation, which is that community quarterback in the Eastlake neighborhood. And again, our role is to make sure that all these partnerships are firing on all cylinders, that everybody's working together correctly and working together in a way that makes sense. It's almost like, have you ever renovated your home?
No, I can't do anything.
Well, you're a lucky man then. If you're going to renovate your home, home, you don't have all the subcontractors sit around your kitchen table and have them decide what they're going to do when. You know, you and your family have a vision.
Right.
And you will talk to your general contractor about what that vision is, and then your GC is responsible for executing upon that vision and making sure that you and your family get what you want. The community quarterback does a lot of that same kind of thing. So they help work with the community to create the vision. What are we trying to get to at the end of the day? And then help hold all the partners accountable for doing the right thing at the right time for the right amount of money to achieve that vision that had been articulated by the community.
Yeah, make sure that people do what they said they were going to do.
That's right.
In the time frame they said they were going to do it.
And that's right.
That you can't overstate how important that all is.
Can I give you one quick example of how that can work?
Yeah, please do.
So when you have all these really well-meaning partners in a community, people delivering early learning and health and wellness services and housing and education, they all bring a way of doing business to the table, how their institution does business. And sometimes that is decided by people in another office downtown because they're running maybe 15 different early learning centers. And so one of the things that the community quarterback can do is kind of get up to that 15,000-foot level and identify small ways that your implementation partners can change how they can do business in order to be able to work better together. That's really important. So, for example, we coached the early learning provider in Eastlake to change how they selected children who would be served in the 136 spots in their center. We asked them to put a geographic filter, which they had never done before at any of their other 20 centers. And they recognized that by putting that geographic filter, they could make sure that children who were served in their early learning center were then going to be eligible to go to Drew Charter School and be eligible to take advantage of the rest of the services. So we're able to kind of get multiple opportunities and multiple touches and make sure we're on the right track to helping children move forward in their lives.
Well, let's just close Eastlake here. We started with 1995 and what the community looked like then with the crime rate and the low educational achievement and the housing being uninhabitable. Let's take a look fast forward 22 years later. What has been the impact of this?
It's really amazing. We were trying something because we had to try something. You know, shame on us if we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we would all say we were more successful than we ever could have imagined. So crime rate has been reduced, 75% reduction in crime for the last 17 years, and that's been sustained. A 90% reduction in violent crime, that's been sustained. And we've done that without a focus on police or without a focus on security. It's because of all these other great things that have happened over time. Kids are doing great. They're going to Drew Charter School, now one of the highest performing schools in Atlanta. It is every year, continues to serve a majority of children who come from families who qualify for free and reduced lunch. And those are low-income kids at Drew Charter School outperform the non-low-income kids in both the city and the state of Georgia. Our kids can compete against anybody. In fact, they compete favorably with children who live in the ritziest neighborhoods of Atlanta and outperform schools where very few children of low wealth go.
That is quite a story. We said at the outset, the mission of purpose-built communities is replication. So looking at the possible universe out there, Carol, how many highly distressed urban neighborhoods are there in this country?
We think there are about 825 urban neighborhoods that are ripe for this kind of disruptive innovation. We think those are the places where more than 30 or 40% of families live below the poverty level, and that they are in urban centers really that have the possibility of having this kind of dramatic success.
Mm-hmm. And you guys provide free consulting services to community leaders interested in implementing this model. How do you go about identifying these communities and judging whether this is going to be a good fit or not?
We have a pretty rigorous process now of identifying when we're invited to a community. We have this rigorous process now of vetting to make sure that we are a good fit for what that community wants to accomplish and that the community has both the stick-to-itiveness, the leadership, and the access to resources to be able to do that. The big buckets that we look at in terms of whether or not we're a good fit, first is leadership.
Yep.
Most important thing is if you have great leadership at that community quarterback level, if you have civic and business leaders who are willing to step up and say, I want to help solve this problem, that's the single most important thing.
things will happen.
Exactly. We also have to be able to do mixed income housing. And while lots of the places where we work also include a single family strategy, our model always needs to be able to have a mixed income apartment rental development at the heart of it, because that's the only way you can get to scale and size and continue to be able to serve really low income families at the same time. And then the third piece is around education. Can you really create that neighborhood serving school that will help lift kids up and be an anchor in the community?
Let's talk about a couple of these communities if we can. One of them is Omaha, where the community quarterback is an organization called 75 North. What impact have you seen there?
Oh, I'm so proud of what they've been able to accomplish in Omaha. 75 North is led by a remarkable man named Othello Meadows, and they have a great board that supports Othello. But we just held our conference out there, our annual Purpose Built Communities Conference, and so just came back last Wednesday from Omaha. They've built now their first 108 units of mixed income housing. They've got about 200 more units planned that will be implemented over the next couple of years. They've got a great partnership with Omaha Public Schools and have reconstituted Howard Kennedy Elementary School with support from my colleagues at Purpose Built Schools, and have really brought that STEAM and project-based learning model to this school, which will serve as an anchor to the community. They're partnering with health and wellness providers and are building this amazing community center called the Accelerator, which is really marrying up for-profit, nonprofit, educational, and health partners who want to be in the community. Everybody from Big Mama's Soul Food to Whispering Roots Aquaponics will be there. It's a pretty amazing place. It's really transforming that neighborhood, how people think about the neighborhood, and improving opportunities for people who live there.
Very cool. Let me cite one other. Birmingham, Alabama. Woodlawn Foundation is a community quarterback. What's unique and distinctive about them?
Oh, the Woodlawn Foundation. Sally Mackin is the executive director of the Woodlawn Foundation. And I think one of the things that they have done so well has really been to become a part of the community. They were invited in to the neighborhood by a lot of existing nonprofits who recognized that they were all doing little bits and pieces, but nobody was thinking about the whole. And so the Woodlawn Foundation was created and invited to be able to serve that role of the community quarterback. And Sally calls herself somebody who leads from the middle.
Yeah, pushing
the pile.
And talks
about pushing the pile, exactly, which I understand now is a football term.
Yes.
I thought it had something to do with dirty laundry, but no. But Sally pushes that pile forward and gets a couple of extra yards on every single play. So they've had a great relationship with the Birmingham Public Schools. They've built new housing. One of the coolest things they have done is they used money from the federal mortgage fraud settlement case to do a homeownership repair program for single family homeowners who lived in the neighborhood. And I think they've done over 160 houses in that community and to help improve the housing stock for people who live there.
Yeah. And I can just hear hope in your voice. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what you see everywhere you go. Yeah. These communities, after so many years, are really having hope.
That's right. I think that's one of the most important things that we can bring in our work is real hope for folks who live in the neighborhoods, that they too can participate in the American dream. And it sounds a little corny every time I say it, but I believe it to my core being that if we can help create these healthy places with broad, deep, durable pathways out of poverty, we're going to tap into this huge human potential that our country has been missing for years. And I find that so hopeful and joyful that I get excited about it.
I gather. And I do, too, just listening to you. Let me close with this, Carol. Through the East Lake Initiative and now taking the model to other communities and getting the same kind of successful outcomes, you got a pretty good idea of what's working. So what do you see as the biggest impediment, the biggest obstacle to having more and more neighborhoods, and there are about 825 of them, as you mentioned, taking this on in their own community?
I think the biggest impediment right now is identifying local leaders. Once we have that kind of core group of local leaders, anything is possible.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's hard to find those local leaders. And, you know, sometimes we're invited to a place by a university or a philanthropist or a mayor or somebody. And when you say, who are the people in your city who help make great things happen? They'll look at you kind of blankly because they don't have that kind of social capital, or they don't have the culture of people stepping up to help solve problems. And in cities where that you don't have that kind of culture, where people say, oh, woe is me, it's bad, it's always been bad, and it'll never be any better, that's a hard place to get started. But most places in America have this wonderful history of civic and business leaders stepping up to solve problems. And if we can tap into that, we can largely make this happen.
Well, Carol Naughton, the president of Purpose Built Communities, I want to thank you so much for being with us this evening. For people who want to learn more about the organization and how this model works, maybe even in a community where it could be implemented, where can they go to access that information?
I think the best place to go is our website. Start at www.purposebuiltcommunities.org.
Well, thanks, Carol. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. I loved being here.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
There were many hardships faced by the people of Houston, Florida, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands as a result of Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. But one of the more underappreciated ones was the damage done to books and other educational materials in home and school libraries. This was not lost, however, on the nonprofit and social enterprise First Book. And we have with us now, to tell us what they're doing about it, one of our favorite guests here on The Business of Giving, Kyle Zimmer, their president and CEO. Good evening, Kyle, and welcome back to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much, Denver, for having me on today.
So tell us about this new campaign that you've launched.
Well, you know, as you just said, everybody has been certainly aware of just an unprecedented season of devastating hurricanes and the wildfires out west, and millions of people across the country. And, you know, we are certainly aware of their immediate needs of water and food and medical needs and electricity. But First Book has really stepped out to try to address the educational needs and the needs to restock schools, the needs to address even immediate needs in shelters for displaced families.
Mm-hmm. And what's the name of this campaign that you've launched to try to address this?
Well, we have a couple of different campaigns going. One is called the Essentials for Kids Fund, and that is a campaign that we have launched at the national level with the American Federation of Teachers. It's been wonderfully successful. We have raised funds and already taken truckloads of books into the Houston area. We are preparing similar efforts in the Florida area, and the plans are on the books for Puerto Rico as well.
Mm-hmm. And you've had some other great funders, including the Barbara Bush Houston Literacy Foundation, right?
Exactly right. The Barbara Bush Houston Literacy Foundation, they have stepped up at being the heroes that we always know they are.
Mm-hmm.
And they have those wonderful, deep local roots in Houston and in that region. And so they've really supported us both financially as well as helping us really get feet on the ground with the American Federation of Teachers, of course, so that we know the books are getting right where they're needed immediately.
Yeah, and what's unique about this campaign also, Kyle, is that I understand 100% of the funds raised will go directly for that purpose?
Yes, it's correct. You know, the campaign has multiple layers. There's always an immediate need when families are pulled out of their homes and placed in temporary shelters. And we know that that's a time of real stress for the adults. It's a really frightening time,
yes,
frankly,
it is, yeah,
for the kids. And it's wonderful to be able to reassert some normalcy and give some comfort in those settings. And so we've been really focused on those settings. But in addition to that, we've been simultaneously working with the Houston School District, with school districts across Florida, and soon we will be moving into Puerto Rico to help as well. You know, one of the things you forget is that the timing of these storms was particularly awful because it was just as the school year was getting ready to launch. And so you had kids and families, some of whom were struggling already economically, and they'd saved their money and they'd bought all their school supplies, and all of that was washed away,
yeah,
you know, in a single storm. And then the teachers had spent money almost always out of their own pocket. The average teacher spends about $600 a year out of his or her own pocket, and they had bought school supplies and they had prepared their classrooms. And it's everything from books, of course, but art supplies, school supplies, backpacks. It's everything you need to, you know, to get the year off on the right start.
Well, this is an extraordinary initiative, Kyle. Does the Essential for Kids Fund have a campaign goal?
Well, we do have a campaign goal. We want to raise $500,000. We already have about $273,000.
Wow.
And I'm pleased to report we have 1 million books from 13 different publishers. So the publishing industry has been extraordinarily generous, as they always are, to try to really, you know, stand up in the lives of kids and really elevate what can go on in these schools that are rebuilding. You know, one other thing I wanted to make sure that I mentioned, Denver, is that when we say essentials for kids, we really mean essentials. In addition to the school resources, we are also providing a huge array of things like hygiene kits and clothing like socks and underwear and some of the things that you might not think about at first blush, but that are critical to a child feeling prepared, feeling, you know, like they have the self-esteem and those basic fundamental resources that allow them to walk through those school doors ready to learn.
Well, this is such a real and tangible thing where people can really make a difference. How can they get involved?
Well, I want everyone, all of your wonderful listeners, to go on to our site at firstbook.org. And on that homepage, you'll see a link to these wonderful efforts. I also want to say that our friends over at the Dolly Parton Imagination Library effort, their campaign, they have stepped in, and we are also running campaigns with them. So you can go to our homepage, or if you're a fan of Dolly, for heaven's sakes, go on to her site, and it all goes to the children and their great heroic teachers and educators who are trying to rebuild lives.
Well, thanks, Kyle, for what you and First Book are doing and for sharing this with us tonight.
Thank you, Denver.
And that is this week's show. We're off next week, not for football this time, but hockey. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and do return again on November 12th for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.